From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
So you've had it with the rat race and feel you've just got to get away? We'll arrange an escape for 2 or 3 months far from everything snowed in at an isolated cabin in Montana's Yaak Valley, or if you prefer heat, on a desert island. What would you need to maintain your sanity? Well, we'll supply you with plenty of food, of course, a dictionary, a Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and the tools of your trade. But what else must you have? Hello, I'm Leonard Lopate, and each week I'll be talking with guests about what they would take in their survival kit. Sidney Sheldon is no stranger to lists. His novels, from The Other Side of Midnight to The Sky is Falling, have dominated bestseller lists for the last quarter century. He ranks as the only writer to win an Oscar, a Tony, and an Edgar Award, and the Guinness Book of World Records lists him as the most translated author on the planet. His books are available in 51 languages and 180 countries. Today I've asked him to make up a list of another sort of the 8 items he would put in his cultural survival kit for an extended stay at a remote location. Hi, Sidney.
Hi.
You're a stickler for detail, and you do a lot of traveling to research your books. You've said that you will not write about a restaurant meal unless you've eaten that exact meal in that particular restaurant. So when we asked you to do this, did you immediately rush off to a cabin in the woods or a desert island to get into the mood?
No, that cabin in the woods sounds like a good idea. There are a few people I'm going to miss and a few animals that I'm going to miss, but since I couldn't take them along, I picked out a few other things. I started with family pictures so I can look at them and see Alexandra, my wife, and my daughter, grandchildren, and our animals.
You also asked for a video of South Pacific. Do you think that that was in keeping with our theme of going off to an unpopulated island?
No, it's in keeping with the fact that I thought it was a wonderful movie, and I can enjoy seeing it more than once. And the book was wonderful, adapted from Michener's Tales of the South Pacific.
Now, had you read the book and then seen the Broadway musical before you saw the film?
Oh, sure. I read the book. I've read most of Michener's books.
The Broadway cast had Mary Martin and Ezio Pinza.
Indeed.
And the film starred Rosano Brazzi and Mitzi Gaynor.
Yes.
Have you seen the film a lot?
I've seen it a couple times, and I've worked with Mitzi. In a picture with Bing Crosby, Anything Goes.
Uh-huh.
So that was kind of fun.
Well, maybe we could take a moment to listen to a little clip from the film.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded room, and somehow you know even then, that somewhere you'll see her again and again. Some enchanted evening, someone may be laughing. You may hear her laughing across a crowded room. And night after night, as strange as it seems, and all her laughter will sing in your dreams.
Some Enchanted Evening, a great song.
Beautiful, beautiful song.
In your career, you've written screenplays, moved over to Broadway musicals, back to movies, then to TV, finally novels. Do you prefer doing one more than the others?
I prefer doing novels. When you write in the dramatic form, such as, let's say you're writing a movie, you don't describe your leading man. Because if you describe him as tall and lanky and laconic, and Clint Eastwood turns you down, and you give that script to Dustin Hoffman, forget it. You're in big trouble. So it's kind of a shorthand. You just characterize him. You don't describe the rooms, because the best set decorators in Hollywood are going to be doing those rooms. So in a novel, on the other hand, it is in such depth, you not only have to describe what the characters look like, but what they're thinking, what they're wearing, what their surroundings are like. And I love that kind of writing. You can really get into their minds.
But you obviously have a soft spot for musicals. You've chosen two here. We talked about South Pacific. You also chose Fiddler on the Roof. And you've written the screenplays for Easter Parade, for Annie Get Your Gun. You didn't include those. You've included none of your own work in your survival kit.
No, because I've seen them and I'm interested in other people's works.
Do you keep a collection of your own things?
I have some of them. I don't think I have all of everything I've ever done.
The second one I mentioned was Fiddler on the Roof, also based on the Broadway musical. Did you see the original of that, too?
Saw the original play. In fact, I've seen it twice. I think I first saw it with Zero, and then I saw it with Topol.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was in the movie. And that's a brilliant play.
Do you think the adaptation to the screen was as successful as some other Broadway musicals have been?
I think it was very successful, perhaps not as successful. It's hard to capture the original vitality.
But maybe it was good that Topol was in both.
Yes.
So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidda-bidda-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bidda-bidda-rich idle-diddle-diddle-diddle-man, I'd build a big tall house with the rooms by the dozen, right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with the real wooden floors below. There would be one long staircase just going up, and one even longer coming down, and one more leading nowhere just for show.
So what's the key, in your opinion, to successfully adapting a stage musical for the screen?
Staying true to the original and improving it where the original lacks something. As an example, when I adapted Annie Get Your Gun, which was written by Herb and Dorothy Fields on Broadway, I had a big choice to make. In the play, Act 1 ends with Annie going to Europe. Act 2 begins with Annie coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't do that in a movie. And my problem was, do you show Annie in Europe? And if so, do you show her a lot? Do you do a montage? Do you do specific scenes? That's not my decision to make as a screenwriter. It's the producer's decision, because that's expensive. So I called Arthur Freed and made an appointment to discuss this with him. 5 minutes before the appointment, his secretary called and said he had to cancel it. So I called and made another appointment. He canceled it. And my agent came in to me. I was just a new, fresh writer at MGM. And my agent came in and said Arthur Freed was very disappointed in me. And I said, why? And he said, he's not getting any pages. And I suddenly realized he didn't want to make that decision. He wanted me to make it. He was busy with the showgirls and the music, but he wanted me to do the script without him. And I did. I went ahead and I decided what I want to do with it. Then I brought it in to him. We talked about it and worked it out.
And what was that?
We showed a montage in Europe, showed some of the scenes.
When you watch musicals like the ones you've named here, do you unconsciously think about how you would have done it?
Sometimes I do. If there's something wrong, it hits me, and I think they shouldn't have done it that way. Yes.
But you haven't written one for a few decades. Do you sometimes get a little itch?
Well, it's interesting. I'm now writing lyrics for country songs.
Country songs?
Country songs, yes. I'm working with a songwriter, a country songwriter and performer named Eddie Reasoner. And Eddie came to me and said he'd like to work with me. And I started out when I was very young to be a songwriter. So this intrigued me because country songs tell stories. And I'm a storyteller. So I wrote a song called You Made Me Believe in Angels. Eddie recorded it, did a beautiful job, wrote the music. And we have a tape, which we are trying now to get published. And I'm doing other songs. So that's fun for me.
And had you listened to a lot of country music before you got into this?
Oh, yes. I listen to country music.
My guest on Survival Kit is Sidney Sheldon. And we're going through some of his selections, things that he would want to take if he were off in a remote cabin in the woods or on a desert island. You talked about short stories and country songs, and you asked for the anthology, Best American Short Stories of the Century, the one that was edited by John Updike. If you'll have so much time on your hands, why short stories?
Because I haven't read that anthology, and it is wonderful reading. I've just looked at a couple of stories in the beginning. It's wonderful reading. And you have so many different stories, it's a very thick anthology, that would certainly keep one occupied for a period of time very pleasantly.
Well, usually people have seen this as their chance to read something long, like Remembrance of Things Past or War and Peace.
Well, I've read those.
You've written novels. You've written in the long form on the whole, screenplays, TV scripts. Have you ever written short stories?
I wrote short stories when I was in my teens. And at that time, there were a lot of magazines that published short stories. And I sent my stories to all of them. And they all did the same thing. They sent them back to me and rejected them.
So
never had one published.
You never had one published. Do you think that they were right in rejecting them? Do you think that you did better when you started writing in the long form?
Oh, I think you always do better as you get more experience.
I've read that the early drafts of your books often run to over 1,000 pages, and then you edit them down from there. You can't do that with a short story, can you?
Not very well. No, my original, the first draft of a novel will be anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 pages. And when my secretary types that up, I go to page one and tear it apart. Mm-hmm. She types that up. I go to page one again. I do that for a year to a year and a half until the book is as good as I know how to make it.
Is there a particular short story writer that you like to read these days?
There's someone who was brilliant, maybe brilliant above everybody else, and that was Irwin Shaw. He's a brilliant writer.
Some people have suggested that the best movies actually come out of short stories rather than novels, because with novels you have to take so much out, whereas with a short story you can kind of illustrate it.
Yeah, I think that is true. And to write a short story is, in a sense, like writing poetry, because you have to tell so much in so few words, and that's not easy to do. I think sometimes a short story could be harder to write than a novel.
You also wanted the Raymond Chandler collection. This is your
Oh, yeah. He's wonderful,
selection.
And that's fun to read over and over.
Now, you moved to Los Angeles when you were 17. You grew up in Chicago, then you moved to L.A. Was that Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles?
Yeah, I would say that era was around that time.
Most of your books are mysteries or thrillers. Your first book, The Naked Face, won an Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America. But they're not like Raymond Chandler mysteries.
Oh, no, I write a different kind of book. I get into the characters very deeply, and I try to write the kind of suspense where you never know where the twist is coming, but they keep coming. It's very hard for me to find a book that I can't put down. And when we go to bed at night, we'll look ahead and see how many pages are out to the end of the chapter because we're getting sleepy. We'll say three pages. Okay. You read the three pages, close the chapter, go to sleep. I try to write my books so that when the reader gets to the end of that chapter, he or she has to turn just one more page.
You've suggested here that you start your books with a character rather than a plot idea. But your books are so heavily plotted.
I know. What happens is I do start with only a character. I never have a beginning, middle, or end. I never have a story when I begin. I dictate to a secretary. And as I dictate, ideas start to come. I see where the story is beginning to go. And then I will go off and do research all over the world to make it real.
Like Raymond Chandler, many of your works have been turned into films. Do you like that process?
Well, don't forget, I started in films and television and theater before I ever wrote a novel. So that process is very familiar to me. I mean, more familiar than writing a novel. It was a big jump for me to write my first novel, getting into the characters' minds, because in screenplays you don't do that. So I'm usually the executive producer of those shows, so I do have control of it.
My guest on Survival Kit is Sidney Sheldon, and we're talking about some of the items he would bring if he were to be isolated in some snowed-in cabin or on a desert island. You'd prefer a snowed-in cabin, I suspect.
I would like that, yeah.
The sixth item on your list is an anthology of the best American poetry. Do you read much poetry?
I don't read much poetry, and I want to read more poetry. When I'm writing a book, it's very hard for me to read anything because it means leaving the milieu of my characters and jumping into other characters in other situations. And that's a big jump for me, and it takes me away from my books. So I don't do much reading when I'm writing. And I don't read much poetry. I've read a lot in the past, but now I want to get back to that because I think that's one of the finest forms of expression and one of the most difficult.
Also inspires you to think about how words work with each other?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a magic to some of the poems. They can do so much in so few words.
Do you prefer certain kinds of poetry? Do you like your poetry to rhyme?
I like Robert Frost. I think he's brilliant.
Next on your list is the film Lawrence of Arabia, the ultimate spectacle picture. You're talking about the originally released one or the restored version from 1989?
I'm talking about the original. I don't like restored versions.
You don't? Sometimes they find scenes that have been cut because of the times and put them back in because that's what I think David Lean had wanted originally.
And sometimes they're put in color when they shouldn't be. No, I think when someone like David Lean, who was a great genius, makes a movie, they should leave it alone. If there's something that he wants put back, that's a different situation. But for others to impose their ideas of taste on great creators, I think it's wrong.
What is it about Lawrence of Arabia, of all the films that have been made, that makes you want to bring it along for this extended stay?
Peter O'Toole ain't a bad answer. He was so brilliant in that. And the whole spectacle of it, and the way David Lean did that movie. It was just brilliant. I loved it.
Somebody like Peter O'Toole can make even lifeless dialogue come alive. Were there times when you wrote a screenplay where you said, thank you to the actor?
Oh, sure. Cary Grant always did that.
He could make anything sound like it was witty?
Yeah, all the writers in Hollywood who were writing comedies had in mind Cary Grant for the casting. I was lucky enough to get him a couple times.
Well, let's listen to a little Peter O'Toole from Lawrence of Arabia.
Sheriff Ali, so long as the Arabs fight tribe against tribe, so long will they be a little people, a silly people, greedy, barbarous, and cruel, as you are.
Peter O'Toole.
I met Peter O'Toole in London. We played cards one evening, and it was a thrill. He's a wonderful man. Was a wonderful man.
Does he play cards well?
He played pretty well, yeah.
Because Omar Sharif is a bridge champion. I know, that must have been some card set.
Sharif was a professional. Sharif was in another one of my movies. I think it was Bloodline.
Now, I was surprised when you said Peter O'Toole. I would have thought you would have said the exotic locations because you seem to be partial to them in your own work. You often have characters flying off to Moscow or Rome or Paris, even Siberia.
Yes, in the new book, The Sky is Falling, I went to all those locations all around the world, and it was very exciting.
So you even went to the underground, an underground city in Siberia?
Did not go there. That was not allowed. But I did an enormous amount of research on that city.
There is a place, such a place.
There are 15 of them. They're all secret. And the people working there can never, ever leave. That's a part of The Sky is Falling.
You've said that you turn from writing movies to novels because you have more control over the books. You don't need collaborators. Well, a film like Lawrence of Arabia required lots of people to get made. Do you, on some level at least, admire it for the logistical accomplishment?
Oh, no, I think that's wonderful, but I didn't start writing books because of that. I never objected to the collaborative efforts, and collaborative efforts are what all movies, plays, television shows are about. Now, what happened was I got an idea for a novel, The Naked Face, but it was so introspective, you had to get into the character's mind. And I didn't know how to do that in the dramatic form. It had to be in the narrative form. So I wrote the novel, The Naked Face. And then I realized the freedom for the first time of not having collaborators. And that's when I decided I wanted to write a second novel. And that was The Other Side of Midnight. And that changed my life.
Because it became such a bestseller.
Yes.
Now, you can do voiceover to allow the audience to get into the mind of your character, but that gets pretty clumsy, doesn't it?
Yeah, very clumsy, and it would slow everything down. That wouldn't work for me.
You talked about working with a tape recorder and lots of pads and pens.
Well, I dictate up to 50 pages a day, so I need someone who's very fast, a professional stenographer.
And those 50 pages, you say, then get ripped down to just a few pages.
Those pages, when they're finally finished, are 1,000, 1,500, and they get down to 600, 700.
Part of the fun is letting your mind go in every direction?
Yeah. My advice to young writers would be, when you're doing a first draft, don't be a critic. Be creative. Let it flow. Let it go. Get to the end, and then become a critic.
And when you go back sometimes, you say, oh, my God, how did I come up with that?
Right.
You also wanted CDs of music from George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, and Antonio Carlos Jobim. This seems like one of those test questions. Which of the following does not belong? And I guess Jobim is the one that doesn't
Jobim,
belong.
But I just love his music. The Girl from Ipanema I could listen to over and over and over, and I do. And as for the others, I've done two movies with Irving Berlin. I did Anything Goes, which Cole Porter did the music for. So I love those classical composers.
Easter Parade you did with Irving
Berlin. Easter Parade and Annie Get Your Gun.
Do you listen to music while you're writing to get into a particular mood?
No. A room is quiet when I write. Mm.
So if you were going to write a scene set in Rio, you wouldn't put on a Jobim record?
I wouldn't need that for inspiration, no. It might distract me, as a matter of fact.
Well, maybe we can be distracted for a moment or two.
Good.
With a little Jobim.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça, ela menina que vem e que passa, num doce balanço caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançado é mais que poema, é a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Por que estou tão sozinho? Ah, por que tudo é tão triste? Ah, beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha.
You said that you would never write with music in the background. Do you prefer total solitude when you're working?
Except for my secretary, yes.
Uh-huh. And do you have certain places that you prefer to write?
I have an office in our home in Los Angeles and another office in our home in Palm Springs. So I usually work there.
When you're off on locations.
Then I just make notes, and my wife, Alexandra, is a great photographer. She will shoot pictures of the locations so that when we get back, I can remember exactly what it was that I saw and want to describe.
Do you write every day? Do you have a set schedule?
I write from about 9 to 6. If I can't sleep, I'll get up and write in the middle of the night, and I usually work 7 days a week.
Your wife also helps in the research of your books, doesn't she?
Oh, yes.
Your daughter is a writer?
Yeah, my daughter's a writer, and Alexander goes with me everywhere I go.
So writing is kind of the family business.
I now have a granddaughter who is 16 years old, who's having her first novel published on the Internet.
No wonder you wanted all those family photographs. Finally, you asked for a very large dog to keep away the wolves and bears?
Well, I'm in a lonely cabin where there are all kinds of wild animals. Of course I want a large dog. A Pekingese wouldn't do it. I want some protection.
Do you think that if you were off for all of this time, that you'd be spending more of your time working or relaxing?
Working, working, working.
Well, you obviously don't need the money. You're doing it for some other reason.
I do it because it's what I do. I'm a writer, and that's what I am. We once lived in a house that was near a canyon that caught fire, and the police came and told us all to evacuate, because if the fire leaped out of that canyon, our houses would go. My wife ran in and grabbed what she needed and came out to the car. I went in. I had all kinds of trophies and prizes and valuable scripts and other things. I came out with 3 yellow pads and some pens, and that's all. And I said, I'm ready. Because deep inside, I knew we'd be stuck in a motel, and I had to keep writing. That's all I took.
And you could always replace those other things.
No, the things that I left the house, I could not replace.
Well, valuable manuscripts, of course, but you could replace
the
books.
Yeah, some of it. But I just needed to know. I needed to know that I could keep writing.
So does that mean you really don't take vacations? All of your vacations are working vacations?
Well, we do take vacations sometimes, and it's fun. I relax between books.
When you're working on all of these different drafts, do you show them to other people other than your wife?
Alexander sees it, and my daughter sees it, and that's it.
And then you hand a finished draft to your editor?
My editor or publisher doesn't see it until it's as good as I know how to make it, and that can be after 12, 13 drafts.
How do you turn out so many books?
Because I write fast. 50 pages a day, a book comes pretty quickly.
Well, I suspect that if you were off there in this cabin, we could see 2 or 3 masterpieces as a result.
I don't know about masterpieces, but I certainly would be working.
Thank you so much for participating in this Survival Kit segment for us.
It's been my pleasure.
Sidney Sheldon. For this edition of Survival Kit, Melissa Egan was the executive producer, Barbara Kahn the assistant producer, and Emily Hoppen was the audio engineer and associate producer. Eileen Delahunty provided technical assistance. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Join us next Sunday at 4 on AMA 20 or live online at WNYC.org when actress and singer Patti LuPone will share her Survival Kit with us. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.